guesstimation question. This is going to be a mouthful. How many articles in the Academy of Management Journal does the person with the most articles in AMJ have?
How many what?
How many articles? So what is the amount of articles that the person... What is the amount of articles in Academy of Management Journal that the person with the most articles in the...
11.
11.
And can you please stop breathing?
Yes.
Yes.
It's so loud.
I heard that too often.
Can you please die?
Jesus. Okay, great. Hi, guys. Good to see you again. I think it's more 35.
35. We have 11. All right. Well, I'll log the... Do you have any guess who that illustrious person may be?
Joya.
Okay.
I don't know.
Right, but I logged the answers. I didn't know this person, but maybe you'll...
It's not Joya.
Yeah. <no.
laughs> I wanted to say Hembrick, but it felt so biased that I'm sure it's not true.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, welcome. Hello and welcome to another episode of Desk Reject the PhD Cast, our little spin-off from our usual German language podcast. Today we have a classic old, good old boys club episode. So as you've noticed from the answers previously, on the mics today are
Didi,
Philipp,
and Alexander. So this episode will be some of a two-parter. You'll first hear an interview that I did with Jackie Lane, who's an assistant professor at the Harvard Business School and who did her postdoc at the Lab for Innovation Science at Harvard. And then we will discuss some of the points that were mentioned by Jackie with regards to staying abroad and general career aspirations that we have now after listening to Jackie. And that'll be it for this month's episode. So without further ado, have fun with the interview with Jackie. I hope you enjoy it.
Do we now have to wait the entire time?
We will now wait for 16 minutes. All right. So I'm here at the premise of LISH, the Lab for Innovation Science at Harvard, in the G.H. Paulson School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, together with Jackie Lane, who has graciously enough to lend us her valuable time. So Jackie, if you just want to introduce yourself briefly before we jump into all my pressing questions.
Sure. Well, thanks, Alexander, for having me on your podcast. I'm really excited to be talking with you. I am currently a postdoc at Harvard Business School, as well as the Lab for Innovation Science at Harvard. I've been here since the summer of 2018, and we'll talk more about my experience in a second, but I've been a postdoc for the last almost 4 years, and in about a month, I'll be starting as an assistant professor at HBS in the Technology and Operations Unit, Management Unit.
Perfect. And you mentioned, well, we've mentioned the lab twice already, and this is not very much not the lab that maybe someone would think of in terms of natural sciences with people working around with chemicals or doing experiments in the field of natural sciences. So how would you describe this lab as a kind of a lab for social sciences? How have you experienced it?
Yeah, perhaps it's helpful to give a background, at least in my eyes, of how this lab got started and what it has become and where it's going. And so one of the co-directors or the founder of the lab is Karim Lakhani, and he started this lab to help him with his research because he was studying open innovation at the time about 15 years ago and wanted to do some studies and experiments on open innovation with NASA. And so this lab started originally as a NASA tournament lab, more than 10 years ago. And the reason why I start with that is because it did start as part of a research endeavor. And the question then becomes, why would you want to make it a lab as opposed to just being an individual doing research? And I don't think I can answer that question from Karim's perspective, but I think there's a lot of advantages In terms of how the lab has grown into having different research streams and attracting funding and other individuals, other researchers, other for anywhere from graduate students to postdocs to research scientists to other faculty in wanting to come here and either play a longer role by being a permanent member of the lab. And so the lab has expanded to have multiple co-directors that are not just within the business school, but also in the medical school and also in the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and also importantly, visitors. And, you know, I think this is really exciting and a great way to do research because it allows you to operate in this interdisciplinary environment. You know, where in you get the benefit of getting other people's perspectives who work in a different field, but they are interested in similar problems and questions. But you can still have enough people who are like you so that you can feel like you can speak the same language and contribute in a disciplinary approach. So if you think about the people who have been a part of our lab, it spans from doctors like MDs to economists, to computer scientists, to sociologists. And so it is pretty broad, but there's usually enough people within each of these disciplines or fields that you feel like you have a home, but you can also benefit from other conversations. And I think one thing that is really unique about LISH, which is different from other labs, is that not only is there a research component, but there's an like a programming. And so putting on courses, MOOCs, you know, HarvardX courses, HBS online courses, these are all things that the lab does today. And you do that in a way that it builds these programs and these courses build on the research that the lab has done, but together with, you know, some staff in who have been hired at the lab, you can disseminate that knowledge to not only academics, but people who want to learn about, you know, open innovation, for example, or AI and, and entrepreneurship.
Yeah, so it sounds a bit, to me, from what you said, it sounds like for the founder of the lab, it's a chance for expanding one's own research ideas and being somewhat independent of a department. And for people coming here, it allows them to work interdisciplinary and you know, research, really spend their time researching.
Yeah. And also I think like to feel part of like an entity, you know, and to have the support structure there. And if you think about the way that people like people organize, we like to organize around among within structure. And so a lab provides that structure or the infrastructure for us to come together and feel like we're attached or we have a common identity with one another.
So you're a postdoc here, but PhDs can also apply, or people that want to do their PhDs can also apply to this lab, right?
Yes. And so since I've been here, there's been quite a few visiting scholars who have come, many from Germany, but also from other places in the world as well. And, you know, I think like it really depends. There's no, you know, one way or one approach that people have come to this lab. You know, some people, you know, find LISH on Google.
Yeah.
And then they say, can I come and visit? And, you know, oftentimes, and, you know, I would say like 95% of the time, the answer is yes. And then other times, I think there's a relationship between, you know, somebody at LISH and somebody else who's at a different university. And so that also makes the opportunity to come visit a possibility. But I'd say that there's all sorts of different ways, or perhaps you started working on a project and it was a remote project and then you decide that it would be great to make progress on a research project if you came in person. So there's many different ways, but I think this is a really open place that's welcoming of, you know, different types of people with, you know, different perspectives who are all interested in one or a few of the things that Lish does.
So how have you noticed? You've been here since 2018. I mean, we've had a pandemic in the middle of it, so it's probably not been the full lab experience for the entire time. But how have you seen people coming here on a visit profiting from it? And maybe even how have you or others profited from visitors coming here?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I've realized is that, you know, the knowledge and what we know and the people that we surround ourselves with are, you know, very much, you know, geographically localized. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is it's hard to expose yourself to people or ideas when they're not, you know, within the reach of your fingertips.
Yeah.
And so I think like one of the things that I've really enjoyed about visiting scholars is and visiting researchers is really, you know, this opportunity to get to know and exchange ideas with mm-hmm. people who come from different places mm-hmm. and as a function of that have different perspectives and knowledge. And I think that's what really makes like research thrive, right? Mm-hmm. Is to get to exchange ideas and then also get ideas and perspectives and feedback from people who may see things from a different perspective, because ultimately I think that improves your research.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, that may also lead to new research collaborations. But even if they don't, I think this process of learning from one another is so critical.
Yeah.
And just because a research collaboration doesn't start with you specifically, it doesn't mean that research collaborations aren't going on with the visiting researcher and other people in the lab.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of different ways for you to get to know and collaborate and learn from one another.
Yeah, I think that's true and hard to really communicate without having experienced it. The level of benefit that every party gets from just exchanging ideas in person is advertised a lot by supervisors, by seniors, but it's, I think, hard to realize the benefit of it. It starts with conferences that you realize it, and then settings like these where you can come and visit.
Yeah, really, for sure. That. And I think one of the things that makes it possible here is because, you know, the culture is really relaxed and informal, mm-hmm. and you can totally go up to somebody and say, hey, I'm interested in what you're working on,
yeah.
or I've been thinking about, you know, this certain idea for a while and I would love to talk to you about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that is totally valued here, which I think may, you know, I think you cannot stress the importance of that enough.
Yeah.
Like this, the culture where you feel like you can just go up to somebody and tell them about what you're mm-hmm. thinking. And it doesn't matter whether your idea is great or, you know, not fully fleshed out, but I think you can feel confident about the fact that as a result of the conversation, you'll have a better sense of where you're going.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Bit of a hard pivot now.
Sure.
So you, as mentioned, you did your postdoc. You're now going to start your assistant professorship.
Mm-hmm.
And be interested to hear what goes into the decision of doing a postdoc after the PhD versus, for example, doing your assistant professor position right away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think my response is going to be very individual.
Mm,
and so
that's perfect.
Anybody else may have a different story. But for me, my postdoc was really a time of transition and also pivot for me. I did my PhD in industrial engineering and management sciences, which mm-hmm. is in the engineering school. And I discovered midway through my PhD that I was curious about business schools and also, for lack of a better way of saying it, you know, social science and working with, you know, data sets and potentially experiments too.
Mm-hmm.
And so this postdoc was a super attractive opportunity. And I think it really changed who I am as a researcher and,
mm-hmm.
you know, for me, like find what I'm totally passionate about. And so for me, this postdoc was not necessary. I didn't necessarily think that I could get a professorship position and I needed to do more exploration and discovery of, you know, what I was interested in first. And so, and this I think this postdoc has done that and delivered way beyond my expectations in that regard. So
interesting. That's a really great take. It's a very positive take as well. And how, now you've made the jump, how do you have any idea of how your life will change now from your postdoc position to your assistant professorship position?
I'm sure there will be lots of changes. One thing that I did want to mention about earlier is that, you know, one of the things that, you know, is really helpful about a postdoc too, is that the academic job market has become much, I think, very competitive, and I don't think it's necessarily much more. But what is apparent is that it's important to have publications when you go on the market, or having publications are helpful signals, and or even having papers that are under review or under revision. And the postdoc gives you that freedom to do that and the opportunity to be productive without having other demands on your time, which I think goes to your next question, which was about how it will change. And I think some of that is really just the different demands on your time and how you allocate your attention. And so, you know, while research remains like a core part of what you do, I think there's also teaching responsibilities and other things that you do, perhaps like working with more students and attending other meetings, just different responsibilities. And so I think ultimately research is a core part of it.
Yeah.
I think you have to also be cognizant that you are going to be dividing your time across different different things.
Okay. Well, that's very insightful. It's a take that I think some, at least I'm speaking for myself now as well, very subjective take. That's not very clear. It's that postdoc is actually an opportunity for you to pursue a little more freedom in your research, versus if you go for the assistant professor position right away, it won't just be research. There will definitely be other responsibilities that come hand in hand most of the time.
Yeah, I think it's time to be, to use it the way that you would like to. And I think one way is for you to be productive and also initiate new research projects with different people, and also learn too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then we're pretty good on time. So I just want to know from you if you have any final thoughts for any listeners interested in pursuing a visit or even pursuing a postdoc position, be it at this particular lab or at an institution like Harvard in general.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned, or you asked that, or you said that, because so Lish is expanding, or maybe I wouldn't say Lish, but in terms of Harvard Business School is expanding to have more labs like Lish. So at the moment, as part of the D-Cubed, which is the new institute, Harvard Business School will be hiring more postdocs and to postdocs for each of these labs. And it's going to start with 11 different labs, with Lish being one of them. And then with that, you know, lots of opportunities for different visitors to come and check out the place.
Great. Well, this has been a very helpful public service announcement at the end for our listeners. So based on our listener base, the D-Cubed can prepare for tens and tens of applications after this episode. But I wanted to thank you very much again for your time and for the great insights you provided.
Yeah, my pleasure. And thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. So obviously, how was it? How were the 60 minutes that we definitely were listening to the interview all together right now?
Very insightful.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another interesting point that was mentioned I found in the interview was around the idea of how to progress in your career after your PhD. And this idea of postdoc versus assistant professor. My idea of a postdoc always used to be that it's this thing that has been invented due to pressures in the job market. You want to have a tenure position always after your PhD. You always want to have
tenure track.
Yeah, a tenure track position is always what you want to have. And this postdoc is basically just something that evolved because there's not enough tenure track positions for the amount of PhDs. Now, Jackie had an interesting point in that it doesn't have to be that way. It can have positive aspects as well. What were your opinions about postdoc versus tenure track positions? Maybe Didi.
So I sympathize with So first English recording. Thank you for the invitation. I liked what you said in terms of that it sounded a little bit more relaxed, because when I think that even if I would have the offer now for a tenure track position, I don't feel qualified enough. Mm. And so what she said, she uses it for also, change direction a little bit, right? And get more publications. And that sounds great. I think there's just this status connected to the tenure track position, right? That it's like a success or a failure often from our perspective. So you get the tenure track, you're a success. You get the postdoc, you're a failure. So it seems a little bit like this black and white. And so, really liked her story.
But just to play devil's advocate here, I think there are two aspects that are really annoying. The first one is that you have to move twice, right? So you do the postdoc. And if you don't get the tenure track position out of that, and I think that's quite unlikely that you then move towards a tenure track position within the same university. So you move from Vienna to London, and then to Madrid. And then you move twice within like 8 years or something. And if you also want to build a family, I don't know how happy my girlfriend would be if I tell her, yeah, we're here now. And if you then get the postdoc position, you can actually start applying right away, right?
Yeah.
So you have 1 year cycles and maybe you have 1 year just to settle in, but you also move to a new city. So it takes a lot of time. Also, you get new teaching responsibilities, most likely. Maybe if you're very lucky, you only have a little bit of teaching anyways. And then the next year, you're already applying for the next tenure track position. So the cycle just gets prolonged. And I don't know.
I think the perception of a postdoc really differs between countries. Mm. Also, what you just said, right? How many years are in your postdoc contract then? Because that's a completely different story. If you have 2 years, 4 years, or 5 years.
Mm.
And it depends on the system. If it's a system where you can stay in postdoc positions at the same university, then for me it's just a normal job, right? Because at companies I also might only get a contract for 3 years and then I get another one and so on. And so it's kind of the same story, but we always perceive it as you're pressured higher or out, and not like slowly progressing upwards, right? You're right when we just talked about like having a 2 years postdoc, you're in and you're already out again. But in this case, she stayed for 4 years now or 5 years now.
So at least the way it actually works is 1 year and plus another year. But due to COVID, there was this prolonging of the postdoc. Mm-hmm. However, you have to also realize that this is Boston. There's like, I don't know, I'm just going to say like 10 universities that you can go to within Boston, which are huge.
Okay, this is the Harvard situation.
Exactly. Right?
But that's, I don't know how likely it is that we will be in the Harvard situation.
Exactly.
The more likely situation is that we will be postdoc in, I don't know, Munich, which is still a very good university and maybe reachable, or this is something. And then there are two universities in Munich.
Absolutely. No,
there are more, but two that I know.
That makes these 2 year contracts, I think, in Boston feasible, because you're not necessarily going to be, if you do a postdoc at Harvard and it's 2 years, you're not, thinking in terms of the entire US. You're thinking in terms of, okay, I'm doing this to get a tenure track, or not a tenure track, but assistant professor position at Harvard or at MIT or Boston Uni or Boston College or Northeastern or Bentley. So you've got like, this is your probably where
are
you want to go.
Cars?
Pardon? Yeah.
Yeah, Bentley, BMW, Porsche.
But yeah, so that's to that point. And then another point counter to what you said, Philip, is we're assuming tenure track position equals tenure track, right? You're inherently assuming once I get my tenure track, I'm not going to move anymore. And there's like two points there. A, that assumes you've got your tenure track position right where you want it. That you want to go to Milan, you want to go to Bocconi, and you get your tenure track position at Bocconi. That's number one. But that's not guaranteed either, right? Because it's so competitive. If you're really angling for a tenure track position,
I know.
You have to. And then the second point also is tenure track position doesn't equal tenure. There's also, you know, a certain percentage only of people that actually get tenured. So going into your tenure track, assuming, you know, wow, I now have security, isn't given. Yeah. So you may still, you very actually you have to reckon that you will have to move again.
So does that mean you want to do a postdoc now?
That, from my perspective, so what I thought was interesting is this idea of if you do, tenure track positions are only few out there and you have to be lucky to get any, and it's super competitive. And especially in our situation, thinking that the world is open and we can basically say, oh, I'd love to move to London, so I'm going to do my tenure track. No, but not that I'm saying anybody thinks like that, but it's not as if we could, it's not as if we can choose to move. If we want to go into a tenure track, like we really, you know, we need to take what we get.
Yeah,
exaggerated.
Yeah, no, I know where you come from, but it is more of a critique of the system, right? Yeah. I don't like that we're progressing, like moving in that direction, because it also increases the risk that we have, right? If we now decide to move to a postdoc position and then do that in order to build up the portfolio and the pipeline to then go to a tenure track position, then let's say I have 4 years and I'm 35 and I can then apply to a tenure track position. What if I decide then that I don't want to stay in academia?
The nice thing is, so that's that, to go back to what Didi asked me, I want to do a postdoc, right? I think what changed for me a little bit is before I talk to people.
You don't perceive postdocs as losers anymore.
That's it. Exactly. Exactly.
What would you be looking for in a postdoc now?
No teaching.
Okay.
That's the number. Yeah. No, that's like the number one thing is if I feel like I'm not competitive on the market, or if I do feel like I'm competitive on the market but I don't get any tenure track positions, or there's no tenure track positions open anywhere that I'm interested in or whatever, then previously I thought, well, I'm going to leave.
Yeah.
It's tenure track or basically this, like it's tenure track or I leave.
Again, it just adds a new carrot that lets you stick in the system or stay in the system, maybe even though you're not ready. I mean, we had the discussion a few times. If I don't know if it's impossible for you to move onto a tenure track position after 5 or 6 years of a PhD, maybe it's smarter to leave academia.
Yeah,
I don't maybe. Attack you. I'm talking about myself, right? I don't know if I'm willing to risk in quotations, 3 or 4 more years to then see if I can actually make it onto a tenure track position. I don't know.
I think in some cases you're definitely right, where it's a clear sign that after 5 or 6 years, if you aren't there, chances are low that you're really going to make it then in the same system, right? So then it's probably a good idea to leave. But then there are also other cases where you maybe throughout the PhD, even if it's 6 years long, you find a new interest or something else you want to do. And then the postdoc provides an opportunity for like more time to shift your focus.
But you're framing the postdoc situation as an opportunity. Mm-hmm. I kind of perceive it as something that increasingly needs to be done in order to be competitive towards, or when you want to apply for tenure track?
Yeah,
and
I totally understand it, but your narrative is also a little bit, let's run to the finish line so we can die there.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Because you say basically you're looking at the end of the tenure track because that's when you're safe for the first time, right?
Yeah.
And that's beginning of your 40s, let's put it like that, right? And after that, what do? So you recover then 20 years because you're...
You know how I work. I'm not worried that this will happen. So but yeah.
I think it has to be very, very carefully thought out. And one opportunity for like where a postdoc versus a tenure track would make sense. If you did your PhD and you did all right, but you feel like during your PhD, you realize that certain aspects or certain kinds of projects really interest you more and they're in different fields and you feel like you don't have the network or you don't have really the projects going on. So you want to do, you know, you came from industrial engineering and you realize that social sciences interests you more. So you do a postdoc, which is more in terms of social sciences. Another thing is, well, sometimes there might be projects going on that you're very passionate about or that you don't just want to give up after your PhD. So what happens? You've got a project, you weren't able to finish it in your PhD, you didn't get your tenure track position. And if your only option is, right, then I'm going to quit everything or I'm going to go into industry and act like I'll still be able to collaborate on, you know, on research projects. I mean, by all means, if you think you could do it, do it. But I feel like...
You want to lie to yourself.
Yeah, seriously. Like if you think like you'll go to McKinsey and then on your weekends you'll be working on research projects, have fun. But yeah, in those situations where it's like you've got projects... I mean, maybe honestly, I think the healthiest scenario would be really thinking in terms of, okay, I just want to, you know, I want to finish these projects because I really want to finish them, want to see them to the finish line. I don't have the material for a tenure track. I do know
Alex,
I'll need
America
another one or
changed you. I know. You're way too positive. It really scares me.
No matter what I do, you just
you will now
complain.
Say that you like everything and like the job and are fascinated by your work and so on. It frightens me.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
You force me onto
I'm just
a
saying
position
I got
a devil's advocate. Feels uncomfortable.
Yeah, just saying. I got a tenure track position from MIT and a postdoc offer from Harvard, and I'm angling more for the postdoc in Harvard.
Yeah,
basically what I'm trying to get.
But just because the guard choice is so nice there, yeah,
teaching load at MIT is just too high.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I do think that is also a well thought out, and I maintain my position that. I mean, it's so hard to subjectively think about that, but it's dangerous if you just, you know, kind of stumble into a postdoc after your PhD. If it's just like,
okay,
I don't know what to
this.
Do. I didn't get a tenure track. I guess I need to do a postdoc now without any kind of concrete, I'm going to grab another postdoc. But if you do, like if you have a project and optimally, you've got a postdoc maybe somewhere even where your collaborators are, right? You've got, I don't know, you're collaborating with someone from a certain university. You really want to see that project to the end. You get a postdoc at their institute. You finish those projects. And then if you're at a postdoc position that you were 2 or 3 years at a good university and that gets you a lot of projects done, I mean, honestly, the skills that we're learning and that we're using are in demand in industry also after a postdoc.
I don't know if I would agree with that because you change the way you work changes and I mean you still have your project with industry partners. They become harder to do by the month, right? Because it's just so different how we work. And I would agree with you that we have skills that are in demand, but I don't know if they would want to offer a postdoc level salary.
I mean, if you go for something like senior data analyst, senior economist, something like that, it doesn't matter. I mean, it can even benefit you.
I would agree with you. With the data scientist, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if it's something in the direction of, you know, you want to apply your research, quantitative research skills in terms of, you know, planning, I don't know, going into a tech company and doing the experimental side of things bringing in causal inference more versus simply, you know, correlational statistical analysis and machine learning, and you want to, you know, then a postdoc, you know, it, if you can bring the skills, and if you did your postdoc because you really wanted to finish projects, I don't think it's the end of the line in terms of industry. If you did also, if you did your, if you thought strategically about your postdoc and you said, okay, no teaching, and I'm not going to do a postdoc anywhere, but I'm going to try and do a postdoc at an institution which has a good reputation also in industry. For example, if you get a postdoc at LMU, I think people will still appreciate you in industry, depending on the role,
because
of course.
Because I'm a nice guy.
Because you're a nice guy. True. But yeah, I don't know. I did change a bit of my view on postdoc, also given that.
Feels like an episode to convince yourself, actually.
Yeah.
But we're happy to help.
I'm not, yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. I'm going to end up as a professional freelancer. content creator.
Yeah.
But
YouTube,
yeah.
YouTube star.
That was basically the things that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, before we close the episode, you can't go out here without answering the question of how was your stay in America over the great pond.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely going to homeschool my children now. That's for sure.
Yeah,
and I'm looking into gun ownership.
Do that.
Really convinced
I'm
me.
Looking into gun ownership. Yeah. Pros and cons.
Mainly pros. Very little cons that I have identified.
Also, Alex gained 500 pounds.
Yeah,
the room is full now. No, like how was it, not from the boring work side, but like, did you enjoy your stay? What are the people's like? Did you go to parties, frat parties, something like that?
I'm totally part of Sigma Kappa Alpha now.
Oh my god.
Played in the college football team. No, I didn't go to parties per se. I have to disappoint you. There's no legendary party anecdotes. But it was great.
You didn't go to one party on campus.
I didn't go to a single party on campus. Just boring old researchers.
I'm super disappointed right now.
I think I'd literally be kicked out of a party. They'd smell the 30-year-old stench off me immediately.
There are MBA students.
Yeah, they don't party. Do you MBA students?
Do you know MBA students?
They need to pay like 100K per semester. They don't have
to get to know other people.
Yeah, but
at
they,
parties.
Yeah, I didn't go to those kinds of parties. I don't even know where they take part.
They don't smell your age. They smell your mediocre income.
I've got those are the two. They either smell my 30-year-old energy, or they see I don't have some Freemason signet ring, and I'm not allowed into the private club. Yeah. I can't afford the grade of cocaine they do at the NBA parties. So I've got the
you need to bring the cocaine. That's the deal.
Yeah, and that's like I kind
that
of
would have been your entry.
Yeah, I mean avocados are the price of cocaine right now. So apart from that, it was great. The colleagues were amazing. It was really pretty much everything that I hoped for and a little bit more. So I was able.
Okay, now I'm really, really frightened.
I mean, you complained the last time that I got so goddamn negative.
No, that's true.
And so the really great things, and which I appreciate, I feel like more about the US system, or at least about Boston, is no matter who I wrote and who that person was, it felt like they had a mandate to really talk to young scholars. So no matter who I approached, what position it was, and if they were full professor at God knows Harvard, they'd be willing to talk, and it would be a genuine talk, a first one. They wouldn't simply say, "All right, okay, you know, what's your research? Oh, interesting. All right, bye." It was really it felt most of the time genuine. Not sure. One thing I'm not sure about it, if this is kind of a one-time thing. Everybody feels the requirement, the first time, right? Yeah. Sure, well, okay, visiting young. I was young once, right? I'll give him the half an hour, perfect. But for some people,
I was young once. I see the glimmer in his eyes.
I can still destroy that hope. But for a few people, I'm 100% sure that if I ever get in touch with them again, they will be open to have a chat again.
But don't you think this is somewhat of the vacation mood that you were in? I mean, we have a postdoc here, and he also had a lot of conversation with people within VU, right? Mm. So I think maybe we should adopt a little bit of that approach to our university setting as well, to just reach out to people. And because I think people are way more open than we expect them to be at our home university.
I don't know. I had a few chats in Europe with people, mm-hmm. and the hit rate was lower. The hit rate in terms of even answering. And I did have chats with people where they were looking at me like, what the fuck?
Why do you steal my time?
Yeah, literally. Like, all right. Okay, you wanted to talk. What did you want to talk about? This kind of attitude is like, yeah, I don't know. I can't help you. That's not my field. Or, all right, I don't know. Maybe you read this paper. sorry, I gotta go.
Oh, that's Alex again.
Yeah. I assume
Boston Alex.
Yeah, two months of Europe and you're back again.
Yeah, no. Maybe it was holiday mood. Maybe I came into these chats in a more kind of wide-eyed, look at me in the big city. Little farmer boy from Linz in the big city of Boston. But my impression, at least from that time there, was hit rate was higher. People were more genuine. People were more excited to talk about their research and were more open to just, chat about and just genuine, nothing, no cut to the chase kind of situation of what you want from me. But yeah, so that was nice. Colleagues were great. And also, I really enjoyed what they had going at the lab, which was this open space.
Mm-hmm.
I was part of the lab for a year virtually, and I had a chat to these people virtually. And it was a completely different feeling of, writing an email saying, do you have half an hour to have like a virtual Zoom call? Versus just being in the office.
And not going away.
Yeah.
Hi, can we talk?
It's like staring at them across the table.
Way too close, like 30 seconds.
Breathing down their neck.
Yeah.
You've been following him now for 10 hours. Can you please leave?
The conversations just happened naturally. People, would just walk by. Someone like Karim Lakhani would walk in the office. I'd just say,
who are you?
Bring me a coffee. And it would not always, but it would often result into a, I'm grabbing a coffee. Do you want to go just have a chat? Versus this virtual setting, or if you're in your office, always this kind of thought process of, if I write this person, when do I arrange the time? What am I going to talk about? And it was far more open. And you could, if I had a problem, something with data analysis or some question towards research design, and turn around, look
can
around.
You always ask me, Alex.
You're like all the way. You might as well be in America. You're on the fourth floor.
You're on the fifth floor.
Yeah, exactly. So you might as well be in a different country. If we were all on the same floor, it'd be a very different ambience. You could totally tune out. You could slap on your noise canceling headphones and just be and work on your own. But you could also totally look around and immediately say, I need help. And then they'd say, fuck off. And then you'd ask someone else. And they'd also say, fuck off. But then like the third person would say, yeah, sure. See you crying in the corner. And it basically.
That sounds amazing.
When I cry in my office, nobody comes.
That's true, yeah. I see you sometimes crying. Just try to move faster away.
Yeah. So in an open office, everybody sees you cry. And that's nice.
That sounds healthy.
They do have crying booths as well if you really want to cry in private, but yeah. People will help you if they see you cry. That was great. All in all, I enjoyed myself. Didn't go to a party, but
that sounds like
did have
a
hot pot.
Contradiction.
Did have amazing ramen. Did listen to some live music. Did watch a baseball game.
That's very interesting.
And
baseball game.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely great. Definitely totally understood the game now.
totally understood the appeal.
I got a Red Sox tattoo on my forehead after that.
Oh, I thought
which you haven't commented on yet.
Yeah, I thought it was a rash, actually. Yeah. Very bad rash.
But yeah, all in all,
yeah,
after
okay,
that
cool. Yeah, okay, Alex. I'm very happy. I'm totally not envious. And yeah. Good that you're back.
You learned your lessons from the last
episode. Can't enjoy that anymore. Yeah, yeah. That was great.
But we need to get to an end. This is already taking far too long. I don't want to sully this great conversation I had with Jackie with a rant about some company that pissed me off. So there's no advertisement.
What?
There's no sponsor.
You're getting lazy.
I am. I literally am. I don't have time for this anymore. I'm not getting enough positive reinforcement. Just, I'm going to be honest.
I'm trying to laugh very loud.
Yeah, I know. You're the only one that laughs very loud. Didi sometimes laughs loudly, and then Sophie kind of gives me the stink eye from across the room. But nobody ever writes, hey, really loved your ad read.
Okay, now we're just fishing for comments, right?
Yeah, well, this is why I'm in research, right? It's for the for the awards. Anyway, no ad. If you want more ads, give me more love. Now, to the answer of the guesstimation question.
Yeah.
It was, you were super close and was 28.
Nice.
And this data is totally not accurate. I took it. Great, I just went cool. did like a Scopus search. Half of the data is missing in the database.
And all of the articles from 85 to 92.
I tried another database, which had the complete thing, but it didn't have a citation report. And at some point, I said, "What the fuck am I doing?" And just took.
And we have to record in 3 minutes.
Exactly. And this guy, I don't know. Do you know George Gerard?
Yeah. It doesn't he do with the management thingy of the?
Yeah, who would have thought the management thingy in the Academy Management Journal? Yeah, I've never heard of him.
What does he do?
I had no idea. I didn't have time. It was 3 minutes before we recorded.
Yeah, okay.
And that's the answer. So you won. We need like a point tally at some point. We need to get an intern. Pay us. go to our Patreon.
Pay us.
Right, thank you very much for listening, everybody. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and definitely follow us on Twitter. If you liked our podcast,
oh, please don't.
No, dude.
I still have a meme account there primarily.
Yeah, but not follow us. Follow the description.
Follow people who are interesting.
follow our great content. Follow us also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, everywhere where you listen to us. And please, please, please give us a review. We really love reading them. We haven't gotten one in a while. So okay. If you do, we'll
now
definitely
just
mention
sound
it.
Desperate.
Yeah, well, desperation sells.
Definitely not. No one says that.
Intro, outro, and the ad music is by Blue Dot Sessions. This podcast is produced by Alexander Staub and sometimes by Sophie. The logo is from Stefan Kardosch from Creative Prism.
Was that a front?
No. Jesus. This is the most delayed outro ever. And we are very happy for the recording equipment by the UTV team. I wonder if they know if I still have it.
They do know.
We see when it appears on Wilhelm.
Yeah, definitely. Once we're done, you know, keep your eyes peeled for prime recording equipment on Wilhelm. Thank you very much. This was fun. And you'll hear from us
and
maybe.
Thanks to Jackie.
Thank you so much, Jackie. Thank you so much. I hope you listened to this. It was a great chat.
And maybe give us some feedback if it's okay for you if we speak English. And maybe it's annoying.
Maybe it's super annoying. And then we'll definitely continue in English. all right. Bye-bye, everybody. Good night. Sleep well. Ich glaube, die Leute sind schon... Also, mit denen ich geredet habe, die fanden das richtig cool, was wir machen.
Ja, weil es Amerika ist, da finden alle alles cool.
That's great.
That sounds totally... Send me an email.